I was thinking about a few things this last week. One is that all of you sacrificed something to come on the retreat. You know, it took great energy and devotion and effort for you all to get here. And I think that's quite admirable, because I know several of you faced, you know, different things happening in your life, you know, in terms of, will you have a job to go back to? You know, Kevin's in that situation, and you too. And then, you know, separating from loved ones. And, you know, Miles had a big thing, you know, kind of saying, Mom, look, I'm an adult, I'm doing this. You know, and it was, you know, major effort on his part. And I know for those of you coming from Mexico, the money factor was difficult, and, you know, weather, and also for Kevin, you know, the long flight and the weather, and then the different food, and, you know, Nancy gave up her stipend for 3 months. So, you know, everybody had to make some kind of sacrifice to come to the retreat. And I think that having to make some sacrifice of our worldly security or worldly well-being is instrumental to the Dharma practice. Yeah, because we have to be willing to give up some of our, you know, worldly attachments if we're going to really make progress on the path, you know, because that's one way that we show our dedication and the one way where we set our priorities, you know. So for all of you coming here, your priority had to be, I want to do Dharma practice and I want to do purification, and everything else comes second. What my friends say, what my relatives say, what my boss says, you know, all of that is not as important as, you know, my Dharma practice and making my life meaningful for the benefit of sentient beings, no matter what other people think. And so that's a major thing, because one of the things we're most attached to is what other people think about us. You might have been noticing this a little bit in your meditation. Yeah, has it come up at all in the last 2 months? You know, like we're just a wee bit attached to what other people think and what other people say. Somebody did a survey once, and they found out that the number of people who were afraid of giving a public talk because they might be criticized or look foolish was higher than the number of people who were afraid of dying. Isn't that amazing? You know, and how glued we are to our reputation and to the hearing sweet words of appreciation and approval. I mean, they're just so important to us. And they say that even for the great yogis, you know, going and, you know, living up in the mountain is not too difficult. Staying alone, eating simple food, the heat, the cold, that's not so hard. But to overcome the attachment of what other people think about us is much more difficult. Yeah. And you see this in all kinds of environments. I mean, people kill each other based on reputation, don't they? You know, one clan fights another clan because one person got criticized. Yeah. So all throughout history, you know, just this attachment to reputation. And then along with that, you know, reputation is what a big group of people think of us. Then there's, you know, intimate, personal relationships. And we love wonderful, ego-pleasing words. We're incredibly attached to that, aren't we? We want people to say, you're so wonderful, I love you, you're beautiful, you're handsome, you're talented. You're artistic, you're athletic, you're rich, you're so wonderful, I love you, I can't live without you. You know, we want this, don't we? Look at Kathleen, how happy she is. So we just love this, you know, we eat it up. And if we don't get it, then we get depressed, don't we? We get very depressed. Or we get angry, you know? Kind of, you know, I've done so much for you and you're not at all grateful that how much I've done for you. You know, you should tell me how wonderful I am at least 5 times a day, you know? And we want acknowledgement for every small thing we do. You know, everybody should realize it and tell us how wonderful we are. So, you know, you guys gave up a lot of that to come here on the retreat. So I think that's quite good. You know, it's a very big step. You know, because nobody's going to say, you know, oh, you look so good sitting on your meditation cushion. You're such a talented, wonderful meditator, you know. Nobody's going to kind of do that. So, you know, I think it's quite good. And they say that everything we have to give up, you know, every step we take to do Dharma practice or to go to teachings, you know, because we have that motivation, is a virtuous step. So whatever you had to do, you know, in terms of collecting the dana to be able to come and, you know, your airfare and visa, the whole thing, you know, all that becomes something virtuous. You know, all the planning that you did, you know, all those files and emails. Now, it becomes something virtuous because of the motivation. Hopefully motivation was good. I think so. Yeah. But, so I think it's important to acknowledge all of that. That was one thing that I wanted to talk about. A second thing was, you know, just to acknowledge, you know, we have a little bit of, you know, monkey mind, garbage mind. And I think, was it yesterday that we had the turkey scenario? Yesterday or the day before when we were sitting at breakfast. And there were about, what, 5, 6, 7 turkeys right out the kitchen window. I think it must be mating season. There was one male, you know, and he had a span thing. You know, he thought he was really something like a peacock or something. You know, I mean, turkey guys just don't make it like peacock. But, you know, he thought he was a real handsome dude. And he was chasing all these other turkeys, and they were all fluttering around, going round and round and round and round. And Miles goes, you know, that's my mind. So I was thinking I should have named the book Taming the Turkey Mind. Because they were an outer display of what our mind is like. I mean, running here, running there, going, oh, making so much noise. So this morning I had to laugh because I was meditating, and then I hear really close to the cat, nah, 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 you know, all this kind of noise. And I look out the window, and there's the male turkey, you know. He's right outside there with his fan spread, you know, no other lady turkeys around. Looking at me in the window, you know. And then and I looked at him, and I said, you know, you shouldn't flirt with a nun. Because I'm not going to fall through for some turkey. So now I know where that expression came from, you know. Remember teenage girls, what you used to call the guys you didn't like? They were turkeys. Now we know. Yeah, how much negative karma did we accumulate calling people animal names? But anyway, you know, but I really had to laugh because it's just sometimes, you know, it's like outside looks like inside. I thought the letters we received from the inmates this week, the ones at least that were shared, were really very touching and very moving, weren't they? So there was one of them that I thought I wanted to clarify something, because it came up in one of our first discussions where we were talking about purifying the negative actions that we've accumulated. But then also I was talking about, like, if you have some situation that's really plaguing you and coming up in your meditation, that you can put Vajrasattva in that situation and purify all the people involved and the whole environment and everything. So it might have appeared that I was saying that we purify things that happen to us. Okay, so I wanted to clarify that, because these are like uncomfortable situations that we find ourselves in, or things that people have done to us and we still carry a bad feeling about it. When we put Vajrasattva in that situation and purify the people and purify the environment, we're not purifying other people's karma, because we can't do that. Okay, so we're not really purifying what has happened to us, because anyway, we can't undo it, it happened. But what we're purifying is our reaction to what has happened to us. Okay, our reaction to what has happened to us. So there might be some event when you were a child, let's say, you know, that was a very negative event that you still have some, you know, resentment or something like that about. So if that comes up in your meditation, you can put Vajrasattva on the head of the person who was bothering you or in the situation. That event has passed, you know, and we can't make it not occur. We can't purify the other person's karma. But if we're holding on to something from that event, that's what we're purifying. Okay? So let's say in the past, you know, somebody said something really cruel and mean to me, and I'm still holding a lot of hurt, or I think I'm stupid because somebody said that, or, you know, whatever it is that I'm holding on to, then by purifying the situation and the people in it, what I'm doing is I'm also imagining being a different person in that situation. So instead of being that child who took in all those negative words and took it to heart and created a self-image out of it, I'm now, you know, kind of this pure being with Vajrasattva on my head. And I know now I don't have to take that personally. And all any negative feeling I had about the whole situation, Vajrasattva's in there spreading that white light everywhere, and he's on top of the other people. They had the other people in the situation purifying them, so in case they had some kind of afflicted mind of anger or despair or whatever going on, that they're now free of it. Okay? And so in that way, then when I look back on that situation, instead of falling back into my old habitual emotional response, I can look back at the situation in a very, very different way, and it's clean, clear, and I'm not lugging around with me my negative feelings about what happened to me. Okay. So that's what I meant by we purify our reaction to what happened to us. Okay? Yeah? Let me give you an example. One person once told me that when she was 5 years old, her father, you know, kind of took, she did some, like, in a, you know, silly thing that a 5-year-old does, nothing major. but I guess her dad was in a bad mood or who knows what, or was a violent person, but took off his belt and chased her around and really beat her quite severely. And she just remembers feeling like, I will never let anybody do that to me again. And as a result, you know, she has had many difficulties with people in positions of authority. Okay? Now, it's not to say that the thing started with her father and that childhood event was the catalyst. We're not doing therapy here where we trace it to one event in childhood, because probably difficulties with authority, I mean, they came from previous lives. That tendency's there. We probably all have it. But then that seed gets watered in that particular situation. And then our mind makes it very solid. And then every time we meet somebody who's in authority, we're reacting out of that same five-year-old mind. I'm just giving this as an example, okay? Okay, so we all have our own stuff that we're doing that with, right? We all have different varieties. One person, it might be attachment, some person might be jealousy, and some person might be inferiority, you know, all different stuff. But when we find that, then you take Vajrasattva in there. Okay? So you're this five-year-old purified by Vajrasattva. So you don't have to feel that somebody is, you know, trampling on you and you're an unfree being. Because now you can look at your father and realize this person is suffering. You know, here's a suffering sentient being whose mind is out of control, who did this to a child that he loved, and how much he must be hurting. And so there's Vajrasattva on his head purifying him of all his pain and the negative karma he accumulated. And Vajrasattva's purifying me of my hatred and my issues with authority. And Vajrasattva's sitting in that room purifying that whole room, so that when I think about that situation again, I don't even get that same feeling tone in my mind. Okay? You with me? Okay, so I wanted to amplify and really clarify that so that, you know, people understood what I was talking about when I said that. And then, you know, one of the letters also was quoting me as saying, you know, just live in this moment and the past is past and forget about it. So I wanted to clarify that too, because if the past is past and forget about it, what are we doing here purifying? Okay? So the past exists. It does not exist now. The future exists, but it also does not exist now. So the only time we ever have to practice is now with what exists in this very moment. However, we exist within this continuum of, you know, past, of future becoming present, becoming past. So what we do in one moment influences what happens to us in the next moment. Okay? And so we try not to live in the past in the sense of carrying around emotions from the past, either happy emotions and trying to recreate them now, or miserable emotions and letting them color how we react to situations now. We don't want to do that. Okay? But living in the moment doesn't mean that we forget the past totally, because we did learn things in the past that are useful that we're trying to use. Okay? And I'm talking about this because, you know, there's all this stuff in Buddhism about forget the past, forget the future, just live in the moment. And so people take that to mean, okay, I'm living in the moment, I'm eating my ice cream, I'm really enjoying this ice cream. You know, I'm in the present moment with this delicious ice cream, enjoying it, tasting this ice cream. I'm being mindful of the ice cream. I'm being mindful that I'm getting attached to the ice cream. But the past and the future don't exist, so it doesn't matter because I'm mindful of it. That's not what being mindful of the present moment means. Okay. Some of you may know Miriam from DFF. She has recently had to move into assisted living, you know, and I talked to Janet when I was, you know, in early February when I said, Janet's her daughter, and she was saying, you know, Miriam's just really, she said, Miriam is really in the present moment. Yeah? So she doesn't remember what you asked her 30 seconds ago. Yeah. She's really in the present moment in the sense of what's happening now is as long as you have her attention. This is not what Buddha meant by living in the present moment. Okay? Because we have things that we learned in the past. We have conditioning. Yeah, some of it's useful, we want to continue it. Some of it is not useful, we want to purify and let go of it. But all of this we do in the present moment. So instead of hanging on to dreams of the past and how wonderful that was, and I want to recreate it in the future, or instead of just, oh, this and that was so horrible in the past, and these people betrayed my trust, and blah, 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 and hanging on to that and going into the future with that, what we're trying to purify is those negative reactions and those afflictions, which we purify now in the present moment, because this is the only time we have to practice this now. Okay. So that then as the future becomes the present, you know, what we're going in with is different. Okay? So we want to be able to look at our past in an honest way and acknowledge what went well and what didn't go well and learn from it. So when we made mistakes in the past, learn from our mistakes. You know? And I think this is what you can see so much in the prisoners' writings to us, is how much they've learned from their mistakes. And so that is what we should be doing too, you know, through all of this. And not carry things around with us from the past like a sack of potatoes, you know, that's weighing us down. But also we can't just dismiss it and say, oh, you know, I did this horrible thing in the past, but it's the past, so I don't need to purify it. Mm-hmm. Well, no, because the karma is, karmic seed is still with us now. Mm-hmm. Okay? Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I wanted to clarify those things that came up in the letter. Yeah? Okay. And another thing I wanted to talk about while I'm pushing buttons. Remember last week I was talking about how this is a monastery and how as a monastery, you know, we receive the food that we've eaten with gratitude and we pray for the benefit of the people who offer to us. So there's many things that happen when you live in a monastery that make it different from living in a layperson's house. You know, and everybody who comes here learns this slowly. You know, I mean, one thing is we don't leave our personal stuff around because it's not our house. It's a monastery. So we, you know, we clean up after we're doing things. But another thing, okay, is in a monastery, we don't put pictures of ourselves or our objects of attachment around our room to look at, to remind ourselves of them. Okay? One of the reasons is, I mean, we live with this body. Do we need pictures of ourself too in order to confirm to ourself that we do exist? I mean, in trying to cut our self-centeredness and the ego grasping, no, I think one way is we don't put pictures of ourselves everywhere. You know, because pictures are, you know, here's me, I'm important. So that's why we have pictures of His Holiness, you know, and Geshe Zopa and Khenpo Rinpoche and the people who are important to us in our Dharma practice, and Shinrezi and Tara and Buddha and Kuan Yin, and, you know, they're all around. Because when we see them, that reminds us of our Buddha nature and our Dharma practice. when we see ourselves in a photograph, it reminds us of, hey, there's me, you know. I even think sometimes it would be good to cover up the mirrors so we don't get so used to, you know, always looking in the mirror. And, you know, in the outhouse there, was it you? And there's this little mirror wrote, who? You know? And I put up in there, I was going to put a big sticker that says, me! Because that's what we think when we look in the mirror. There's me! Real, solid me. Look, even the external environment reflects me to myself. I can see me. Okay? So, you know, pictures of ourselves, pictures of the people we're attached to. Okay? Again, because it reminds us of the people that we're attached to. It cultivates our attachment. It gives us a sense of security, you know, in the sense, okay, there's me and then all these people that I'm attached to and related to in various ways. So because, you know, I'm this one's husband or wife or son or daughter or friend or uncle or aunt or whatever it is, therefore, you know, I exist in this web of human beings. I exist. And I'm important. And I'm kind of permanent because there I am in a photograph. And they're the people I'm attached to. And they're permanent also because there they are in the photograph. You know? And so when I get lonely, instead of turning to the Buddha Dharma Sangha for refuge, I look at the photograph and I daydream of how it was like when that person hug me, you know, or I daydream about the nice vacation we had, or I daydream about some other kind of situation of attachment that helps me not feel lonely again. Okay? So it takes us away from our present experience and from really facing the attachments and different things, doesn't it? So I'm not saying throw away all your photographs, because they're nice to look at with friends where you can all laugh about how funny we all looked. Okay? So that, but to have them on display as a way of reinforcing ourselves, that doesn't fit in with monastic life. Okay? Another thing that we have in a monastery is we don't have tchotchkes. Okay, tchotchkes is a Yiddish word for all you Catholics who don't know. all you Catholics who spent your time persecuting us. A tchotchke is a doodad. You know, a memento, a souvenir, the little things, little decorations that you put around you. Knickknacks, knickknacks. Tchotchkes are knickknacks, okay? And, you know, how do you say knickknack in Spanish?
Adorno.
Yeah, like an adorno. Yeah, but a little kind, you know. So, I know somebody's going to go, well, I saw two stuffed animals in your room. So I think I better explain the two stuffed animals. Okay, because those would fall under the kind of thing that I'm saying you don't have in a monastery. Okay? The two stuffed animals, one was given to me by Serkan Rinpoche. The other one was given to me by Zopa Rinpoche. So they're Dharma protectors. Okay? The one that Serkan Rinpoche gave me, the little dog, you know, her name is Delightful, because what Rinpoche was getting across to me when he gave it, and he wanted it to have kind of a name like Delightful or Joyful or something, is that it's important to keep your mind happy when you practice the Dharma. And you keep your mind happy not through attachment, but through the Dharma practice. Then the little bear, that's from University of Wisconsin, Lama Zopa gave me. And when he gave it to me, he put its hands together and he was able to press its belly. So it went, you know, I take refuge in the Guru. I take refuge in the Guru. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Dharma. Okay. It's the refuge bear. Okay. So that's why there are those two stuffed animals, you know, the itty-bitty ones on the windowsill, okay? Those are the reasons. Otherwise, I wouldn't have them. Yeah. But again, you know, it's something that we free ourselves from because we like to have tchotchkes and decorations around. So, like, for example, when we have the flowers, yeah, we don't just buy flowers so we can put them in the house so we can look at flowers. The flowers are always offered to the Buddha. And that's why I thought it was so nice that, you know, we had the picture of Geshe Zopa on the file cabinet, and then you began to create a little altar there. You know, that you're making offerings. And, you know, now we have the little etched thing of the Buddha and Kensa Rinpoche, and it's become very sweet, and we offer the altar, the flowers there, okay? So that we don't just have, you know, pretty things around for us to enjoy, but everything is functional and serves a purpose, okay? And so we try not to have things that we don't need or things that we don't use. It's another part of the simplicity of living that you know, we're trying to have us in a monastery, and you're living kind of that lifestyle for these 3 months as a way of cutting out distractions to our Dharma practice and cutting out a lot of the attachments. Okay. So now I can see you all, you know, you go in the bathroom and lock the door, and you pull out your little photo and look at it. You put it away secretively. You come out of the bathroom. I wasn't smoking. Like, Manju, the kitty, you know, he goes and looks at the fence. I mean, he has this whole yard to look at. What does he do? He looks at the fence. You know, and because that's where the little mice are. So when I walk over there, and the mice are on the other side of the fence in the long grass, when I walk over there, then he walks out towards me with this innocent look like, I'm keeping the precepts. So we're going to be like that with all our little pictures and things like that.
Because Patricia's picture is at the hall.
Oh, that?
And I was always like... But he's practicing. I am not... Tengo la culpa de
You can rejoice for these practices. Carlos is practicing too. Okay. So I wanted to kind of talk about that too. Okay, then another thing that Bo brought up in his letter about being walking, talking, breathing dichotomies. Yeah. Somehow, in one of the initial letters that he wrote us, a dichotomy is like a contradiction, two things that are opposite that can't go together. Okay. And so I thought that was very, you know, honest and astute of him to recognize. And I think that this is something for all of us to look at in our meditation, because I suspect we're all dichotomies, okay? And especially in terms of view, I've been reading the Pali Canon, you know, during the retreat, and the Buddha talks so much about right view, and so many of the sutras are refuting the wrong views that people had at the time. And in the Eightfold Noble Path, the first one is the right view. So that means having the correct intellectual understanding of what samsara is and what the path out of it is. Okay, so just having the correct understanding. You don't even, we're not talking about deep realizations here, but the correct understanding. And so we gain that through learning the teachings, okay? And then we start to contemplate it and think about it. And in that way, we begin to get some confirmation of the teachings, and then we meditate on it to really, you know, gain the realizations. But especially, you know, at the beginning of the path, you know, we're very much dichotomies because we come to the Dharma with all of our old conditioning, yeah, and all the views that we grew up with. And then we're learning the Buddhist view, which is very opposite to a lot of the things that we believe that we grew up with. And so, you know, we become Buddhists, we become Dharma students, or we start practicing, whatever it is. And we have, and we believe, you know, what the teachings that we've heard, we've examined, or, you know, to some extent, and they make sense to us, and we believe it, and we begin to have this worldview of, oh yes, you know, there's rebirth and, you know, there's karma, and what I am is a product of what I did in the past, and what I'm doing now is creating the cause for what I'm becoming in the future. And at the time of death, it isn't just one big blank and nothing happens, but my mind goes on. It takes a rebirth according to what I've done. And, you know, oh yes, this is all, this whole system of cyclic existence, one rebirth after the other, it's fed by the afflictions, specifically ignorance, anger, and attachment, and karma. And so, you know, what we have to do is be able to cease the ignorance, because then the attachment and the hatred cease, then the karma ceases, then the rebirth ceases, then we attain nirvana. And, you know, and so we get some idea about that. We get some idea about bodhisattvas and developing this incredible love and compassion and altruism for the benefit of sentient beings. And so we have, you know, we all have to varying levels depending upon how much we've studied and heard teachings and read and thought about it, you know, some kind of conceptual thing. Where the dichotomy comes in is we have our beliefs, and we, you know, we'll talk about them with our friends and, you know, everything like this. But how much do we live according to our beliefs? Okay. I mean, we all say, oh, yes, I believe in karma. But when we make decisions in our life, do we make decisions as if we really believed in karma? You know, when we make decisions, are we really thinking of, what I'm doing now is going to create the cause for my future, you know, what is going to happen to me in my future rebirth, or what I'm going to do now can be a cause for liberation, or it can be a cause for enlightenment, or it can be a cause for hell? Do we think about that when we do things? Or what's the actual criteria that we use for making decisions in our life? Okay. We have this whole view, this world view, but do we live our lives as if we actually believe in the world view that we say we believe in? You know, or is the major criteria by which we make decisions my pleasure, or my reputation, or my receiving love and appreciation, or my receiving gifts, or my not getting criticized by the people that I like? You know, what are the criteria we use to make decisions in our life about what we're going to do? So these can be major decisions where you have time to think about things and decide, or they can just be decisions that we make in our day. You know, somebody says something to us that we, and our mind says, oh, that person is, you know, talking very rude to me. So just the impulse, which is a decision of sorts, to say something back to them. You know, to get defensive or to attack back or to say something mean back to them. You know, what were the criteria that we used to make that decision to retaliate verbally? You know, at that moment, were we thinking what I say is going to create the cause for my future rebirth? Were we thinking what I'm going to say is going to help or hinder the path to enlightenment? Or was the major, you know, factor making us determined to say those harsh words, I'm going to protect my reputation, nobody's going to talk to me like that? You know, which is attachment to our own pleasure of this life, isn't it? Yeah. Or another situation comes, you know, we talk so much about how wonderful it is to be generous, how generosity is good, generosity is the cause for happiness, and it's the first far-reaching attitude, and the whole path is about generosity, and, you know, I'm giving my body, wealth, and enjoyments to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and to all sentient beings, and I can do the Tonglen, and I, you know, I'm giving all this stuff away. But I want that piece of chocolate that's on the table there. And I got it. I don't have to give it away, you know? Kind of to look at, you know, we have all this wonderful rhetoric about giving, but do we practice giving in small situations? You know, so many different kinds of things like that. I'm not saying that we're bad because we don't live every value we espouse. Okay? Because we're not Buddhists yet. So we shouldn't get on this, on our own case and say, oh, I'm such a horrible person. I believe in generosity and I'm so stingy and, you know, I believe in, you know, in kind speech, but, you know, what comes out of my mouth is horrible and, like, I just can't practice the Dharma. It's all useless and I'm a hypocrite and I'm a phony and let's just give it up and have a beer. Because that's what my mind does, isn't it? You know, our mind, you know, built up this whole thing about how we can't practice anyway, so we might as well, you know, smoke a joint, have a beer, you know, go to the movies, go, you know, do something. Okay? Chase Dorsey. Oh, they made me laugh so much, those turkeys. All day today I was laughing about them. Okay. Yeah. Especially that one outside the window. It's like, come on, guys. Anyway, back to the topic. Is, you know, we shouldn't beat ourselves over the head, you know, because we can't live what we espouse 100%. Because our Dharma practice is a work in progress, isn't it? You know, we start by having the worldview. We start by getting our good values. But we don't stop there. We then try and practice. Okay? So when we're practicing, sometimes we succeed and sometimes we fall down. We're like little babies learning to walk. You know, sometimes they manage a few steps and sometimes they go kaplunk. Okay? But the idea is when you go kaplunk, you pick yourself up and you keep trying again. That, by the way, those of you who have wondered why I have a scar on my lip, that's where the scar came from. I was learning to walk. I went kaplunk, cut myself on an ashtray. Neither of my parents smoked, but they had the ashtray there for guests. And that's why I have the scar. You know? But you pick yourself up and, you know, I'm walking now. Okay. But, you know, so it's the same thing in our Dharma practice. So we shouldn't get discouraged because we can't live everything perfectly. But we also shouldn't go to the other extreme of being slack and say, oh, it doesn't matter. Okay? So we may be talking, walking, breathing dichotomies right now, but what we're trying to do is become an integrated bodhisattva. Okay, so this is a work in progress, and it's going to take some time. But we're quite dedicated to doing this because we really see the value in it. Okay, so it can be good in your meditations. You know, two things from here. One is to do some evaluation, do some research. What criteria do I use to make decisions? Either major long-term decisions that I think about in advance, or actions that I do, you know, in the next 30 seconds. What criteria, you know, are conditioning me when I make decisions? And how wise are those criteria? How wise are those criteria? Are those criteria really things that are going to bring about happiness and liberation and enlightenment? Or is it just the same as the criteria, me, I, my mind, self-grasping ignorance, self-centered thought, my pleasure, my reputation, my being loved and appreciated, okay, my getting what I want, my not getting what I don't want? What is it that's conditioning, you know, that I use this criteria? Okay, so that's one point to bring into your meditation, spend a little bit of time on. Because this, you know, the more we can refine our criteria and then really take time and make our decisions with wisdom, then the more we will be putting our values into practice in our life, and the less we will feel like dichotomies and hypocrites and phonies, you know, because we'll be much more integrated. Okay? And then the second thing to get out of this discussion is, don't beat yourself up because you're not perfect, but don't just lie back and do nothing. Okay? So just remember that our whole practice is a work in progress, and that you are making progress as you go forward. Okay? So have some faith in yourself when you do this. The other thing I wanted to talk about, how the different things, you know, because I come back from our discussions and I think all these things that I have to wait a whole week before I tell it to you, is, and this came up a little bit in our discussion last week when we were talking about our non-negotiables. You know, what are our negotiables and what are our non-negotiables? You know, have you been thinking a little bit about this? And to also do some research, how much of the purification am I doing is linked to my non-negotiables? In other words, often to get the things that are non-negotiable, we create a lot of negative karma. To get the things that, you know, we must have, that we've said to ourselves, I must have, I'm not giving up, we often create a lot of negative karma to get those things. And we often create a lot of negative karma to keep them. Or we create negative karma to to keep them, because we often have to harm other people or do things against the people who are threatening to take away our non-negotiables from us, or things that interfere with us having our non-negotiables. We often create a lot of negative karma that way. Okay? So I don't know. I mean, what's an example of a non-negotiable? Give me an example.
I'm gonna have a romantic relationship.
Okay, I'm gonna have a romantic relationship. Okay, so first of all, I have to look good. Right? Because nobody's going to fall in love with me until I look good. So, that means I have to, you know, do something with my hair. Oh dear, my mother was saying that for years. I have to do something with my hair. You know, I have to go to the gym. I have to stay fit. I have to go on a diet to gain weight or to lose weight or to do something. Okay? And I have to wear the right kind of clothes, you know, to attract the kind of guy that I want. Okay, because you got to look a certain way to attract that kind of guy. So here I am. I'm going to work to get the money. You know, this is all done out of attachment, right? It's all attachment to you know, jump in bed with somebody. But, you know, to be able to jump in bed with somebody, first I have to go to work and, you know, get the money so I can buy the clothes, you know, and get the makeup and get the hair dye and go to the gym. And, you know, make myself so I look good, and then I have to, you know, go places and, you know, try and look around for some guy that, you know, doesn't look like a turkey. You know, and then I have to put on this whole image of who I am. You know, because if he knew what I was really like, he'd run away from me. So I can't let him know what I'm really like, you know. Because if people know what I'm really like, you know, they're not going to want me. So then I have to create this whole image about, you know, how nice I am and how good I am and you know. And then, you know all this trip, the whole thing you do when you try and attract somebody. So we've all done it. Yeah. And, gee, those memories come back easily. That's why they're you know, so then you have to do this whole thing. And then you have to make sure that your friends like him. Yeah. And that he likes your friends. And so then if one of them criticizes the other, if one of your friends criticizes him, then you either get mad at your friend or you dump him and go get somebody else, you know. So when you dump him, then you have to say all these mean, cruel words. So you create a lot of negative karma out of, you know, hatred, you know, towards him when you dump him. Or if you get mad at your friend because she criticized him and you decide he's more important than your friend, then you say nasty things to your friend. So you create a lot of negative verbal karma that way. So you have all this karma created out of covetousness, karma created out of deception. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we're not really being truthful about, you know, we think we're being truthful, but, you know, we're letting the person look at one side of us, not the whole thing. We show them the rest after we get married, and then they go, what happened to you? You know, and then we create negative karma because people, you know, one doesn't like the other. And then, you know, the whole, then of course, you know, okay, so you fall in love, fall in attachment, you get married. Then what happens? Then you quarrel, right? You know, the person that you care about the most, you fight with. You know, because finally they're being honest and you're seeing all this stuff about them that you don't like. And then you're being honest and they're seeing stuff about you that they don't like. So you quarrel. So there's a lot of harsh words, okay? A lot of malicious thought, a lot of vindictiveness, okay? A lot of hurt feelings. Then sometimes there's lying involved. Or you decide, oh, he's not treating me well enough, I'm going to go flirt with somebody else because that'll make him jealous and then he'll treat me better. So you go flirt with somebody else, then you create, you know, unwise sexual behavior. Then, you know, then there's lying to cover that up. Or then even if you get along and you have a good relationship, you know, somewhat good, you know, then you need to go do things. You have to get presents to the for the person that you love. So sometimes, you know, you're not quite honest on your taxes because you want to have more money so you can take the person that you care about on this nice vacation. So, you know, there's all sorts of things that you might wind up doing, dishonest things, in order to keep the other person happy. Yeah. And then, of course, once you're together in a relationship, you gossip about each other's families, don't you? And you put down everybody else in the family. Yeah? Isn't it? You know, the two of you are the best ones in the whole family. You criticize all these brothers and sisters, criticize those brothers and sisters. You wind up the best, too. Okay, so lots of negative verbal karma that way. Okay? So you can see, you know, and then coveting, because you need to create this nice house. So you're coveting, you know, you're looking at all the catalogs. You go in the mall and you're dreaming about this, that, and the other thing. And coveting stuff to create your house. And then the stuff you get in your house breaks. So then you get angry, and then you call up the repair people, and then you yell and scream at them and create negative karma that way. And so, I mean, you know the idea, don't you? You know what happens. So, you know, just, and I'm sure you can do a much better analysis of this by making an example in your own life of what happens. You know, the kind of negative karma that we create by following our non-negotiables, and the amount of time that we often waste by following our non-negotiables, in the sense that we have this precious human life, which in all of samsara is like so rare and difficult to get, to have a human life where we've met the Dharma, where we have our health, where our senses are intact, where we've, you know, have access to the Buddha's teachings, to a teacher, to a community where we have time to practice. I mean, getting the situation we have to practice is extremely, extremely rare. I mean, you know that situation in the scriptures, they talk about that blind tortoise coming up, you know, in the huge ocean once every 100 years, and the golden yoke that's floating all around. And what's the chances of the tortoise coming up and his head going through the yoke? It's like, you know, very, very difficult. So here we have this situation. We're perfect for practicing Dharma and, you know, really ceasing suffering once and for all. And what do? We spend our time in the shopping mall, you know. Or we spend our time in the ski slopes. Or we spend our time, you know, whatever our non-negotiables. And so we get some temporal pleasure from it, but that pleasure is gone the next moment, isn't it? I mean, we've all had incredible amount of pleasure in our life. Where's that pleasure now? It's not here. We have a whole bunch of memories, but what do memories do? Yeah, memories are living in the past. So, you know, so much of our life gets wasted. You know, chasing after that kind of pleasure that doesn't last. Now, I'm not saying that everybody, you know, needs to, you know, be some kind of, you know, Mickey Mouse ascetic or something like that. But, yeah. And I'm not saying don't have fun. Yeah, I mean, people often get very confused and they think that when you're talking about giving up attachment, it means you're not supposed to have fun or you're not supposed to have pleasure, that pleasure's bad. Thinking like this is your residual Christian upbringing. Okay, remember last week we were talking about, you know, the stuff dragging on from when we were kids and, you know, how we need to recognize it. This is a very good example of that. Okay? Buddha did not say, you know, pleasure is bad and having fun is bad and you should look grim and, you know, be serious all the time.
that if you do anything you like, you're sinning. Okay, Buddha did not say that. If you're thinking that, you're thinking that. But that's not what Buddha said. Okay. So, I mean, look at the Dalai Lama. Does he look like a miserable person who has no fun in his life? No, he doesn't. I mean, he looks like a very quite happy person. Ajahn Amaro, he's a Western Buddhist monk in the Theravada tradition. He tells a story about how he met the Dharma. But, you know, first he was on a Thai beach, you know, and kind of, he's my generation, we're about the same age, and, you know, kind of doing what people of my generation did on the beach. And you know, the whole nine yards and just pleasure, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then he happened to go to one monastery and he heard about all these monks keeping 227 precepts and he thought, oh, all these horrible rules, you can't do this and you can't do that and you can't do this and you can't do that. And he went there, you know, because he felt so free, I can do this, I can do that, I can do this, I can do that, and I'm doing it. And he went there and his big shock was that all these people who had all these rules about what they can't do were happier than he was. He who had no rules. You know? So it made him really stop at, you know, having some kind of ethical discipline can actually, practicing some kind of restraint, can actually bring more joy and more happiness than having the freedom to follow all of our craving for sense pleasure, you know, a pleasure of some sort. When I say sense pleasure, I'm also including reputation and praise and love and appreciation. So don't just think I'm talking about good food and stuff like that. Okay? So, where was I? About, yeah, we still, you know, we still have fun. We laugh, we can have a good time. But the whole idea is, why are we doing the things that we're doing? Yeah. What is our motivation? Is it just out of attachment, just, you know, shoot the breeze? Or is there some purpose when we're talking, even we're together and having a good time, you know? There's some kind of Dharma motivation, some purpose, some mindfulness of our precepts, some mindfulness of love and compassion in our dealings with other people. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at it this way. If you had told somebody, well, you probably did, you know, you're going on this retreat, you're going to be living together with nine other people, not seeing anybody else for 3 months, kind of sounds like a Survivor show, doesn't it? You know?
Yeah,
one of these reality shows. You know, and to see, like, you know, who gets in competition with who and who fights with who and who, you know, gets kicked out and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, people are going to say, how are you ever going to have any fun? You know, what a boring, horrible life. Are you guys bored? Are you having a horrible life? No, not at all. I mean, what an incredible, loving group of people that you would never be with if you were, if you hadn't come here, would you be? Yeah? So we're not talking about, you know, living some kind of horrible, deprived life.
It's very funny because I've been, several times I've run into that, like, what if they were doing a reality show about this group? And it would be like they keep going, but where's the conflict? Where's the plot? Tom the F and his turkeys run through. The elk are on the meadow. But we can't make a story out of that.
Yeah.
Because nobody's, like, you know, doing each other in or anything. So they just keep looking at the camera like,
what are they going to do? Yeah.
Smile.
Yeah.
Cry on their
faces. Yeah. He sleep cries.
Help each other.
Yeah, help each other. So, okay. so then that the end, at the end of your romantic relationship, okay. So it either ends in divorce, because everything that comes together ends, right? I mean, this is, I'm sorry, everything that comes together must end. There's no way you're together. So either it ends by divorce, or it ends by somebody dying. You know? Are there either of those fun situations? You know? Is it fun you're dying to separate from, you know, your romantic partner? Or they're dying and you have to separate from them because they're dying? You know, it's going to end. It doesn't last forever. Everything that comes together separates. Yeah. So eventually that's what's going to happen, is the separation. So, you know, you can't hold on to the person forever. They don't come with you into your next life. So you're together in this life. How are you spending your relationship, you know, your time together? Are you creating negative karma? Are you wasting each other's precious human life? Or, you know, if you choose to be in a couple relationship, are you really helping each other in the Dharma? You know, and putting the Dharma at the center of your relationship and helping each other purify and create good karma. Yeah. So I'm not saying everybody needs to be monastics. You know, people can choose to live a lay life. But, you know, what's the center of your relationship? And how easy is it to live from that place as the center of your relationship? Or the other part of the romantic relationship is, you know, they go off and have an affair with somebody else, not you going off, but then they go off and then you have to deal with that, what happens when they do that. Okay? Or they get mad at you. Or, you know, I mean, we all know what happens in romantic relationships. I mean, it's the same old thing again and again, isn't it? Just kind of different varieties. Yeah. And we've all been each other's husbands and wives in previous lives. Can you imagine that? We've all been married to each other? Oh, goodness. We've all been turkeys together? So, I mean, this lifetime, we really have something special. No, we've all been elk together. We've all been deer together.